Mr. Richards, rewind. Where were you born, Mr. Richards?
I was born in Bognor Regis in Sussex.
Which year was that?
1928.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a carpenter and joiner.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
To do what?
I went into, during the war of course, and I went into an aircraft works, working on wooden aircraft, airspeed to Portsmouth. And it's a job I enjoyed very much.
How did you come to be in the forces then?
Well, the call-up was still going on towards the end of the war, and my sister had served during the war, and she was still in the Wrens at the time, and I knew I had to join something, because call-up time is coming near at 18. So my sister said, join the Royal Marines, she said. They're always smart and well-dressed and everything, you know. So I said, right, I think I will. I had a cousin who was in them during the war, and he was killed on HMS Hood. So I went down to volunteer, and the least I could volunteer for was 12 years. So it meant I had to serve 12 years with the Royal Marines, or do two or three years as a caller, conscript, for could have been put anywhere, you know, in the coal mines even at that time, which wouldn't have satisfied me at all. So I volunteered for the Royal Marines.
When approximately would you have joined up?
I volunteered in the end of 1945 and was eventually taken by the Royal Marines August 1946. About 8 months later. 9 months later.
When the Korean War broke out, did you know anything about Korea at all?
Well, I knew where Korea was, and I knew that the Russians and Americans had fought for it at the latter end of the Second World War. But I had no real idea of what the trouble was. I'd only just returned from a three-year tour of overseas. I'd been in Palestine and Hong Kong, Far East, and I loved the Far East. And I thought this was a good chance to get back out there again. So I volunteered to go back in the new commander that they were forming, 41st Independent Commander.
Why exactly did you volunteer, though?
Well, mainly, as I say, because I'd served in the Far East and I loved Hong Kong particularly. Singapore and Hong Kong, I really enjoyed my life while I was serving out there. And it was mainly doing exercise and an internal security work while we were in Hong Kong. So I thought it was a good chance to get back out there again. And I enjoyed life abroad rather than stay in this country in the Marines. Plus the fact that I was an experienced radio operator. I completed my signal training before going abroad in the first 3 years. And they were calling for specialist volunteers for this new unit. I thought, here's my chance. So off I went.
Did you expect Korea to be similar to the other places in the Far East that you had been to?
I did. Yes, I did. I thought it would have been, you know, I've always liked Chinese people, funny enough, as I say, in Hong Kong and Singapore. And I got on well with them before, and I always considered that Korea would be similar. And I didn't realise it was going to be such a big conflict. Otherwise, of course, I would never have volunteered.
What did you like about the Chinese?
I don't know. I think they're very much like us. I think they're they respect people, and I think the British people sort of respect, especially old age in the years past anyway. I think we always looked after our old relations, and the Chinese do that. They're a reserved type of people, and I think they sort of keep themselves to themselves. They don't really interfere with other people too much, and I like that. And even today, I mean, Chinese population are here, don't cause us much trouble, do they?
No. So approximately when would you have volunteered for Korea?
Well, the war broke out on June the 25th. I imagine they started forming that unit about July. I can't remember the exact date.
And this was four commando, you said?
41st Independent Commando. It was going to be formed with 120 men. And we flew out by BOAC at that time.
What was the journey like?
Well, we had to be kitted out with civilian clothes because in those days we didn't own our own civilian suits, or very few of us did. And we had to be kitted out because in civilian clothes because we were passing through neutral countries. And we were told if we were asked who we were, what we were to be informed that we were a football team. It was all hush-hush, really, you see. And we landed in, well, Cairo, which was English run at that time, India, Pakistan, Karachi, Calcutta, Rangoon, all the way across. We stopped, you know, and of course it took us 4 days in those days to get there, even by air.
Was it an uneventful journey or...?
Oh, and that was a lovely journey. We landed at Okinawa eventually and transferred to Dakotas to fly us on to Japan.
So, do I understand that your only reasons for going were personal ones? There were no political reasons or anything
No,
like that?
No, although, of course, I was a member of the Young Conservatives as a young chap. I was quite interested in politics, which probably was to be to my downfall later on, really. But at that time, I was quite interested in politics, and I joined the Young Conservative movement, and all my family voted Conservative, you know, being in Sussex, it's a very Conservative area, even those days, more so now.
So did you have any reflections on the causes of the Korean War when you went?
No, I took the newspaper articles, that most of them saying that the North had invaded the South, and we were going out there to help right the situation. You know, America wanted to a bit of aid as a United Nations effort, and I thought, well, this is where we're going, really. And of course, we had all the reporters around us, including the Labour Daily Herald in those days. And nobody would speak to her. I always remember that.
Why not?
Well, they thought, you know, the enemy. It was considered the wrong crowd, I suppose, at that time.
What, they were thought to sympathise with the North?
With the North, I suppose, although, of course, I don't think they did. But she was not the sort of person one could feel at ease to talk to. I mean, even... I couldn't, she was a woman reporter, I always remember that. She had a cigarette sticking out of her mouth, which I never liked to see anyway, with a woman. And anyway, very few people wanted to talk to her, you know, every time she came over, they were all clear off and all this sort of thing. And poor lady, I don't think she ever got many interviews that day.
What were the other reasons why people didn't want to talk to her, apart from...
Well, I don't think many people were politically minded at that time, you know. I don't think politics came into it at that time with the majority. I mean, even I wouldn't have gone out just for that case, you know. It was one of the reasons, but it wouldn't have been the main reason. I wanted to get out because I liked the Far East, you know. I've always wanted to go back there. Even today, I'd like to go back, look around.
What, did you have much contact with these war correspondents?
Well, they were mingling with us while we were on sort of on show to them, because we had to be trained with American weapons. We were going to have all American equipment when we got out there, and it was a crash course of using American weapons and fixing their equipment and things like that. And while they were there, the reporters were roaming around willy-nilly and taking their interviews.
Did you give any interviews yourself?
I can't think I did at that moment, that time. No, I don't think I did. I was rather shy in those days, I think. I wasn't too keen on talking to people too much.
Do you remember any of the other war correspondents?
Well, I mean, they were all there, Daily Telegraph and Daily Express, all the big papers, and News Chronicle was there. And the Daily Herald I remember very well, as I say, because of this lady with the cigarette sticking out of her, which reviled me rather. I thought that was a disgusting sight.
But there weren't any memorable names amongst them?
No, I don't think so at that time. Later on, of course, I met one or two.
Who did you meet later on?
Well, in the camps after we got captured.
Oh, we'll come on to that
later.
We'll
come to that later.
You don't remember Alan Wicker as a correspondent out there, do you?
Alan Wicker, no. I know him, of course. No.
Now, whereabouts did you arrive in Korea?
Well, we landed in Japan at Haneda Airport in Tokyo and moved to an American base at Yokosuka, American Naval Base. It was a Japanese naval base during the war. And we moved to Yokosuka, Camp McGill, they called it, I think. Yeah. And we started training then again with American weapons and getting the unit together, because I say at that time there was only 120 of us. And they got a few more. I don't know the final figure of the commander, but they got a few more from the different British ships that were out there and transferred them into the commander. We were fully trained, of course, commandos. These people were sort of just there to assist us, you know, from the ships. We done some more exercises at Fujiyama, near Fujiyama, climbing up Fujiyama. We were based then in a camp, McNair, which was an American Marine base. We started mixing and getting used to American ways of doing things. And from there, I think we returned to Camp McGill, and we were split into sections. I think I was attached to a B troop, and it was about 50 of us. And we were started to train then at Yokosuka. Working with a submarine, USS Perch. Well, I've got photographs of her there. And we were going to make landings on the coast. Apparently, the American powers-to-be had asked for assistance as a commando raid on the coast of East Korea, as they were transporting lots of supplies on the railway line, which runs down the whole of the East Coast of Korea, from through China and Vladivostok, Russia, you see, which is adjoining. And they wanted us to destroy this railway line and stop the movement of troops and goods. So we trained with this submarine, USS Perch, which was a snorkel-type submarine, means that it could go along the surface of the sea, taking in air to use for its diesel engines without rising above the surface. We were billeted either end of the ship. After the conning tower of the submarine was a great big hangar which contained a motor launch. And what we used to have to do, the submarine would surface to its deck level and the American crew would get up topside, blow up our 8-man canoes, and while they're doing that, we're all ready, you're seeing, coming up, get straight into the canoes. They are connected then to the motor launch, which would tow us into about a mile or so off the beach we were going to raid. And then we had a quick release hook, which we had to pull and paddle the rest of the way, which worked quite efficiently. And it was the first time I think they'd used a submarine for this type of warfare.
Now, you said that you were using all American equipment. How did it differ from that which you had been used to in the British forces?
Well, their machine gun was a Browning machine gun, which was very similar to our Brain. Quite accurate and quite a good gun. Their rifle was a Garand, which fired 8 shots, 300 gram. And it too was quite a good gun, although a bit heavy, we found, you know, in comparison to our rifle. Their carbine, which they'd just introduced, I think, at the end of the Second World War, towards the end of the Second World War, was a lot of rubbish and caused us no end of problems.
Why was it rubbish?
Well, it never worked. Kept breaking. They had a very fine hairspring inside it. We had piles of them that night when we were captured later on, or while we were fighting, you know, just been slung aside. They were useless. It was a useless weapon, I think. Although it was light and things like that, our Sten gun was much better, much better. And then they had an automatic machine gun that you, took the place of our Sten gun, I suppose. The grease gun. I don't know the real name. I think it's a Maxim, isn't it? I'm not sure the official name, but we called it the grease gun and the Americans called it grease gun. It looked like a grease gun for the car. It was quite accurate, although it fired a lot of rounds at once. And they also had Thompson submachine guns, which were very accurate, but quite a heavy gun with the pan or the stick magazine. I had wireless set, so I would carry a pistol, and they issued us with a 45 automatic, which was, well, terrible thing. I don't think much of pistols anyway, but it was a personal weapon. But I mean, the 45 is such a heavy bullet, you know, and to fire one, you've got to be really good at anything with it, you know. And it was a very, very heavy pistol, automatic, so I wasn't too keen on that. It wasn't a lot of good to me later on in the fighting either.
And you were saying that you had to get used to American methods. How did they differ?
Yes, well, as I say, working with the American crew on the submarine, we had to get used to their... I mentioned one of the terms, lay topside. You know, number two boat's crew lay topside. Well, this was all new to us, you know. On deck, we would say, or something like that. And their terms for, the American terms for their code signs on their radio sets were completely different to ours. Suzuki and that was the name of the motor launch. The call sign of the motor launch was Suzuki, and I can't think what perch was now, but they used funny words to us, you know, at that time. Their radio sets, the one that we had was an SCR-300, which was very similar to what we'd been used to in our country as a 31 set, if I remember rightly, which I've been trained on then. Very similar to that, very few differences. But they also had an American set in a Jeep, which was carried in a Jeep, and it was one of these where you used to have to wind up with your hands to get power for transmitting, you know, which was new to us. We hadn't got anything like that. But it wasn't used much because it was destroyed earlier in the battle. So that was out of it. Walkie-talkies, we'd never seen those before. Those are the great big hefty things that they used to carry around those days. Now, of course, they're very elaborate, aren't they? But these were, we'd never seen these before, so we had to get used to using that. Otherwise, we never found a lot of difficulties. Their belt, webbing equipment was different because their belt, ours used to go on to slide on webbing slides and that, water bottle and things like that, but theirs was clipped on through little holes all around the belt. Everything was clipped. Their entrenching tools clipped on at the back, used to hang at the back, ours used to be on the side. And their water bottle was clipped on, and it used to jangle about a bit more than ours. It never made a noise as such, but used to move about far more than ours did, which I don't think was an awfully good thing anyway, because when you're manoeuvring, you know, it can be a bit cumbersome, no idea, trying to move around.
What impression did you get of the calibre of American forces?
Well, but at this time, of course, we were training with the American Marines. We were billeted with them. We weren't training so much with them then. But we were training with the American Navy. And we found no cause for trouble with them. They were very good to us. And we found them quite efficient in every way. And even later on, during the battle, I found the American Marine Corps was quite good, very good, in fact. And their Air Corps was very good. And they had their own American Marine Air Force, you know, Marine Air Corps. And they gave us a lot of support on the way, and they were very good. No. But later on, of course, we met their army, which wasn't so good. But there is a reason for that.
What is the reason?
And the reason was that they were just being called up. And in fact, one of the American prisoners who was with us later on was an American boy. He was only 16 years old. How on earth he got in the army, we don't know. He was a prisoner. And his name was Freddie Brzee.
Freddie what?
Brzee. And he looked a boy, and he was only 16. And they were just weren't trained. They weren't sufficiently trained. And of course, you can't expect anything. We'd had years of training, and so had the American Marine Corps, because most of those people are in for certain periods of time, like we were, you see. So we mustn't blame them for their...
How would their lack of training show itself?
Oh, later on in the camps, very much so, you know, because we've got a term in the Royal Marines, we used to say esprit de corps, you know, everybody works for together for things, and we would help each other and things like that. But we found with the American Army, they didn't do that sort of thing. And later on, to get food and things like that, if somebody was ill or somebody like that, they used to throw them out of the hut to die in the cold, you know, just to get extra rations and all that sort of thing. It was terrible, some of the things we witnessed later on. But I don't blame them really as people, you know. I think this all comes with training. So I'm pretty fair, really, in thinking that way, I believe. I should tell this American author this as well. I might upset him, but I should tell him.
Now, you've talked about what the role of 41 Commando was going to be.
Yeah.
Can you say something about what your own personal role was going to be within the unit?
Yeah. My personal role in the unit, was in the Independent Commando, was to be in charge of the wireless section of 41st Independent Commando. and I had to control all the sections that were sent out. But when we got split up into our different troop actions, as I say, in B Troop, we were designated to USS Perch, the submarine. Other units of about 50 men were designated to USS Wontuck and USS Bass, two destroyers. They were going to carry out raids in the same way as we were from Perch, except that they were on surface ships. And they weren't going to be towed in like we were with a motor launch, you know. They were just going to make an attack from the destroyers. I think they used the PT boats that they used to call, which was the landing craft, American landing craft, small equivalent to our LCAs. I'm not sure what they used on those, but I think that's what they used. They never used rubber boats like we had, canoes.
What was your rank at the time?
Corporal.
Can you describe the operations that you took part in once you were trained?
Yes. Perch was sent from Yokosuka Naval Base, and it was to raid up on the east coast of Korea, Songjin, S-O-N-G-J-I-N, Songjin. We surfaced at night or early morning, like a dawn raid, and the motor launch was launched from the hangar, and we tied up our all. Going to tie up our boats when all of a sudden they spotted some motor torpedo vessels, enemy motor torpedo vessels. The North Koreans had quite a few of those. And the skipper of the submarine got in a bit of a panic. You know, there was a bit of panic stations. They called us all back on board before we had time to sort of get everything in the boat. And they left some of the boats and the gear in them, the explosives. We were carrying plastic explosive. And they left all that above. And we had to rush down below decks again, down the hatchways. And they closed hatches and everything was a panic. The alarm signal was going. Crash dived. We left a chap up in the hangar, up on deck. And an American sailor was left on deck in the hangar through the panic. He was safe because it was airtight, you know. And we had to stay down below all for a matter of several hours and quite some time because the air became very, very stale. And we had to lay on our bunks. We weren't allowed to smoke or anything, people who smoked. It was quite difficult to breathe in the end, you know. And eventually we came off the bottom of the sea. And moved away, and we went even more further north, I think, than we were going to be that night, but I'm not sure exactly where, raided the coast at a different point the next night. We surfaced, hitched up our motor launches, our canoes to the motor launch, and went into about a mile offshore. Slipped and we paddled the rest of the way, and we took 4,000 pounds of explosive and blew up craters in the or laid charges in between the tunnel mouths, because it's very, very rocky and hilly in North Korea, and this railway line goes in and out of tunnels all the way along. And